you know, to me, silence is music as well. Where you choose to have music in a film and where you choose not to place music is incredibly important for the experience of the viewer.
Kaya Wanju, hello, welcome to another episode of The Curb. I'm Andrew F. Pierce, and this is the podcast where I bring you in-depth interviews with filmmakers, creatives, and curators of culture. This podcast is recorded in Boolu, Western Australia, sovereignty never ceded. Nanita Desai is an award-winning composer whose work has spanned creative formats, from documentaries like The Reason I Jump, where she won an Emmy for Outstanding Music Composition, to TV series like Funny Women, and to video games like Telling Lies and Immortality. With over 150 credits to her name, Nanita is nothing short of prolific. In the following interview, Nanita talks about her journey into becoming a composer and how Peter Gabriel impacted her career. While we don't touch on her education in mathematics, it does play a vital role in her career as a composer, guiding her interest in sound design as well as composition. From here, our discussion leads into talking about the role of nature in her work, as heard in films like The Deepest Breath and the 2024 Sundance Award-winning film Nocturnes. In both of these films, the role of the ocean and the mountains is as important as the world of the people we are following, and Nanita talks about the way that she reflects those characters' journeys in her compositions. Equally important is the role that silence plays in her work. Nanita talks about the role that silence plays as the unspoken instrument for a composer, and how important it is to relinquish the score to amplify the drama of a scene. As a flow-on of this discussion point, Nanita talks about the difficulty of knowing that not all aspects of her score will end up in the final film. This wonderfully insightful conversation flows between creativity and personal journeys, with Nanita giving us an in-depth look at the mind of a composer. This conversation was recorded ahead of Nanita's upcoming appearance at the Australian International Documentary Conference, AIDC, which opens in Melbourne on 3rd of March 2024. Nanita will be presenting a discussion called The Art of Composing for Documentary with Nanita Desai, alongside moderator Emma Bortingen. As we close out this interview, I asked Nanita about the importance of being accessible for interviews and panel discussions, which leads her to reflect on the role of being a mentor for emerging composers, particularly women composers. If you're interested in attending AIDC, then please visit aidc.com.au. And equally, if you enjoyed this discussion, I urge you to seek out other interviews that Nanita has done, as they've regularly been in-depth, valuable insights into her art as a composer. And equally, she has so many different stories to talk about her work as a composer and so much insight into the different films, projects, games that she's worked on, that each of the interviews that you listen to or read is going to be a very different journey. So hopefully you enjoyed this one alongside those ones if you do seek them out. And if you like what we do here at The Curb, please head over to thecurb.com.au to listen to other episodes or read reviews. The Curb is completely 100% independent, and it operates on the support of listeners like yourself. Please consider becoming a supporter via patreon.com/thecurbau, where you can support The Curb from as little as $1 a month. For now, here is Nanita Desai on the art of composition. I want to start by talking about Peter Gabriel, because I hear that he's played a fairly pivotal role in your interest as being both a sound designer and a composer. And I'm curious if you can talk about the origins of where you wanted to be a composer and how he folded into that journey.
Well, I've always had a fascination for sound in the natural world. And so as a young teenager, I would go around with my portable recorder, DAT recorder, and a pair of headphones and just record sounds of nature and sounds around my travels around the world with my parents as a young kid. And I was also very much into technology. I loved computers, and I have a degree in mathematics, and I was very much a sort of like a techie, geeky, tomboyish girl growing up. And I was into computer programming, and I loved synthesizers and music technology, and so that was all wrapped up in one for me. And so I ended up going to university to do maths because of peer pressures, and I thought, well, you know, becoming a composer or working in the creative arts wasn't something that was on my radar as such, because I thought I couldn't make a living out of it. I had no idea what these roles were. So I started off having an academic background. And I then got a scholarship to do sound at the National Film and Television School, sound for film, sound design. And I also love film. I was a reviewer of films for the student newspaper, and I immersed myself in going to dusty old cinemas in Soho, reviewing movies with all the great film critics in the UK, in London. And so I sort of fell in love with the storytelling power of sound for film. You know, watching, loving films like the new French wave of cinemas like Betty Blue and Luc Besson's movies and the Coen brothers movies, where sound was very, very important. You know, the legend in Barton Fink and the Hudsucker Proxy and all those kind of movies. So while I was at university, I did a sort of like a music course as well, a music postgraduate course. And I, by chance, accidentally met Peter Gabriel, who came to the university. And I was writing a piece of music software, and he came round and looking at what the students were doing, and he said, oh, this is really interesting, Nanita, why don't you look me up when you finish your course? And of course, how do you look up Peter Gabriel? I was a big fan of his music because I also learned Indian classical instruments when I was growing up. I learned to play the sitar and the tablas, and at school I learned to play the violin and the piano. So music was very much a part of my DNA growing up. And then I got into sound for film as a sound designer. And I did that for a couple of years, and I got to work on some really big movies, and I helped me understand the landscape of sound for film and the way you can tell stories with sound and not just music as well. And my roots and passions really lay in music. So I remembered what Peter had said to me, and I wrote him a letter, and I contacted him. And at his amazing studio complex in the UK called Real World Studios. And I got a reply, a phone call saying, would you like to come and visit us? And I went along, and I got offered a job to be Peter Gabriel's assistant music engineer. And that led me down a different path from sound design. And I got immersed in the world of music engineering and working with some of the world's greatest record producers, Daniel Lanois and Brian Eno and Peter, working with Peter and all these amazing musicians that would come in and out of the studios, like Sinead O'Connor and Papa Wemba with this fantastic West African band, and Billy Cobham, this amazing jazz drummer. And so there were a lot of creativity in that period of time, of working and collaborations with other artists. And that opened up a whole world for me in terms of music production and music engineering, and it appealed to my love of music technology and computers as well.
What I'm really fascinated by, having absorbed and listened to your music quite extensively, when I was looking through your filmography, I'm like, well, of course I've listened to that in your films. And then, you know, in preparation for this interview as well, I've been, you know, immersing myself in the scores that you've done. And it's fascinating to see how you look at the world through your music. And I'm curious about how working with those people and being in the orbit of these great musicians and artists, how that shifted your worldview in a sonic landscape?
Well, I mean, for me, it's all about storytelling, always. As it is always that, you know, whatever project I'm working on, I have to be deeply immersed or find the truth in that project. And so, you know, having worked with all these artists, and that taught me a lot about not just the technology, but what it taught me, what I learned from Peter was about the magic of capturing the magic of performance and the spirit of the energy and the creativity that's going on in the room with all these amazing musicians. But also, you know, moving away from that sort of that creative hub and moving into scoring for television and starting off my career in documentaries. You know, those are my roots, really. And I love telling stories through music. And for me, you know, even though I score scripted and fiction and video games and all sorts of other genres, my first love has always been documentary because, you know, I love being a part of the jigsaw puzzle of collaboration and working in teams of people and finding a connection. For me, there's a greater purpose, if you like, or greater reason for me to be able to tell a story. I mean, I'm a filmmaker in my own way, telling a story through music. And finding a way to connecting the music always to the story and to the heart of the essence. So, you know, whatever the project is, sort of in a very sort of immersive way, finding that authenticity and truth, whether it's something like For Sama, which is a film about a woman's experience in the Syrian revolution, or the world of autism in The Reason I Jump, or the experience of what it feels like to be a free diver in The Deepest Breath, you know, that's always, I mean, it's super important to me. And because there's nothing worse as a composer than having a blank page and you go, well, what's my way into this story? And so I do a lot of research as well around the story. I love listening and speaking to and having the dialogue with the filmmakers. So it's being part of the filmmaking team and that sort of organic evolving process of the film and being a part of sometimes, you know, in these feature documentaries, being involved for me, which is a long time, a year and a half or 2 years, you know, from very early discussions, so that you find a way where the sound and the visuals and the story seamlessly find their way together into, you know, the end result.
So, like with a scripted film that's not a documentary, you'd usually have the script to go with, and then, you know, they do the shooting, and maybe you might compose to some kind of cut down the line. But I'm curious for you then, for documentaries, where do you come on in the process? Is it before they've even shot, or is it during shooting? What stage do they engage with you as a composer?
Well, my preferred way always is to come on as early as possible. So, you know, like I said, with For Sama or The Reason I Jump, I was on those projects for a year and a half with The Reason I Jump, you know, while they were filming and the right from the before even the editing process. With For Sama, they edited for 18 months. So I was on board through the entire process, right up until the final mix. So that's, I tend not to get a script, but I do get a pitch deck, or I might get story beats. I might get, you know, very detailed notes of the beats of the film. But things change so much that you're on that journey sometimes. Sometimes directors have very clear ideas about the music, the stylistic direction and the approach they want to take. And that gives me a framework within, you know, those boundaries, so that I have a tonal direction of where to go. Do we want a big orchestral score, something like 14 Peaks, Nothing is Impossible for Netflix? That was a joy to write for, because the director and the editor had a fairly clear idea of what they wanted for the score. And then for me, it was finding my own path and my own truth in terms of incorporating some kind of cultural elements combined with the big orchestra, the power of the orchestra for the mountains, and to portray the fear and the tension. And in that film, you know, there are two characters in the film. One was Nims, the mountaineer, and the other character were the mountains themselves, and how to kind of straddle both of those characters and portray them through the music. In some respects, I'm a kind of a conceptual. I like coming up with concepts for scores, and then it gives me, I can put together the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle slowly and evolve. And sometimes, you know, I'm working on a feature doc at the moment, which is absolutely stunning, beautiful film. The cinematography is incredible. And it's very, we've been going down one path, and then the directors changed their minds. We went down another path to make the score more orchestral. And now we've changed and reverted going back to the original path. So, you know, there's no right or wrong, that you're always sort of exploratory.
Hmm. What I find also really interesting is, and you bring up the mountains, but, you know, the landscape is such a strong component of the narratives that you compose for. Of course, there's the ocean and the deepest breath, and then Nocturnes, which I saw via Sundance earlier this year, which was just a stunning film. Like, it's a visually stunning film, and, you know, it's all about nature. But alongside that nature is the story of the people who are living alongside or within nature. And I'm curious if that's like a thematic thing that you seek out in projects, or is it just something that happens to emerge throughout the projects that you work on?
Interesting. It just happens to come my way. I mean, I'm working on a film at the moment which has got nothing to do with nature. I've got a few projects I'm juggling, but those, I think there may be a common thread running through many of my feature documentaries, which is about what it means to be human, putting human beings in extreme situations, whether it be the world of freediving, whether it be a woman living through a war in Syria, or people living in extreme conditions, you know, extreme endeavors. I worked on a film which was on at Tribeca, and it's coming out on Hulu in North America, I think, this in March. It's called The Contestant, and it's about a Japanese game show host, one of these endurance shows where he has to live in a room, a 10 by 10 room for 15 months with no clothes or food, and he wins his way out of his captivity. And this is extreme Japanese endurance game show play. It's a bonkers story, and that's what attracted me to the film. I thought, I have absolutely no idea what to write musically for this project. I'll take it on. I like taking on challenges. And I mean, as much as I love writing music for films that are in beautiful settings or very harsh, extreme settings around the world, like the underwater ocean, the deepest breath, or the mountains and so on, or nocturnes, you know, I'm more interested in the human condition and what human beings do to themselves, and what makes us human, and what defines us as human, and because there's so much, there's so much nutrition there to sort of pull from, as a composer, that, you know, you're sort of, I also see myself as a psychologist, you know, and translating that into music. So we're sort of understanding the human condition and what we do, who we are. Always had that curiosity. So it's great to be able to explore that through documentaries, which I find, as much as I love telling different types of stories in different genres, obviously scripted and fiction, I think there's nothing better than a true life story, which can be more extreme or fantastical than any fictional story that you can find. So I think it's a very interesting sort of landscape to explore.
I mean, that's the thing about documentaries, isn't it? Is that there's no more, you know, in the realm of cinema, documentaries are so profoundly human because it is real life. It's you know, obviously there's editing and things like that. It can be, you know, shifted and changed and stuff. But whatever it is, it's still the core of it is human life. It is human stories, and that's what I find so fascinating about the films that you've chosen to work on and to share the stories. And in particular with The Deepest Breath, I find it really fascinating because we have these two different characters who we're waiting for their stories to intertwine, and yet they both kind of have their own kinds of themes. And I'm curious if you can talk about how you present the characters through score in a documentary like The Deepest Breath.
Well, I've never scored a love story before, a romance. And that's one thing that really appealed to me about The Deepest Breath. This is actually a beautiful story about two people that come together and find each other and find their truths and who they are through, they happen to find that out through their worlds and experiences of freediving. And then there's the world of freediving itself, which is this described as this extreme sport. Because it is extreme, you know, and working with the underwater landscape sonically was also very interesting to me because I've never done that before. So there were a lot of firsts for me on that film, you know, the love story, the relationship between these two people coming together, finding themselves, and then the world of free diving. And I, I like to do my research, and I have to say I did not go diving and I have no desire to go free diving. In fact, after having worked on this film, it just makes me think, why would anyone want to do this? But I have an understanding and an appreciation for it, because it's, even though it's described as an extreme sport, it's not extreme. It's not a sport as such. It's, because it's the total opposite of being an extreme sport, because you have to be at one with yourself, and it's very meditative and it's very poetic, and the world of freediving is very internalized. And so musically, there was lots of inspiration and lots of narrative threads to go down. So one was to produce the beauty of the relationship of these two characters. The other was to make the audience understand or have an awareness of the internalized world of the free diver and the meditative nature. And so the director, Laura McGann, wanted me to have two sound palettes, one theme and sound world for Alessia, which was derived from the use of the female vocals. But I'd never want to go to use musical cliches. So it's an obvious choice to use the female vocal because she's a woman free diver. But I thought, well, I used breath is very much at the heart of this film. You know, the way that the divers use their breath to go down to the bottom and come back up again. The vocals that are in the film are very sung in a very, very breathy way. And I sing some of the vocals as well, which is my connection to Alessia. And then with Stephen, he's on a mission to find himself in his early years before he settles in Dahab with his freediving center. So he's traveling the world and he's searching for himself. So there's a momentum and an energy to the music. And I settled upon strings and the cello, and that's his sound. So that when these two characters meet about halfway through the film, and there's a connection there between the two of them. You hear their themes coming together with the cello and the human voice, and they kind of intertwine and form this beautiful love theme that you hear when they fall in love. And you hear the theme at the end of the film as well. And then the other side to the score in the film, conceptually, is the power of nature and the intimacy of the human diving as a soul diver amongst the power of the ocean and the waves and the crashing waves. And so the opening titles of the film sort of kind of encapsulate that juxtaposition, the contradiction between the epic power of nature. And then you hear a solo viola playing this theme, which represents Alessia and the intimacy of the journey of the diver. So you've got the tension. That's something that another aspect that we wanted to bring out is the tension of being a free diver and the danger and the perils of the ocean. And so there's the climactic scene in the film, which is about 12 minutes long, towards the end of the film, two-thirds of the way through the film, has this dive sequence which is full of tension and danger. I won't give the ending away as a spoiler, you know. But it's very dramatic, and there is a series of very complex things that happen in the scene. So you think there's no music, but there's music running all the way through this long, complex sequence of events that happen underwater. And the music is there to help guide the audience as to just sort of highlight the tension and the danger, but also never to get in the way of the complexity of the scene. And because it's important that you know where all these characters are underwater with these series of events that happen. So that, you know, blending music and sound design, because of my roots as a sound designer, have, you know, awareness that it's, you know, we can use sound in a very powerful way to help the audience navigate what's happening in the story-wise in the scene. So the music and the sound design work hand in hand in a very subtle way as well.
That's one of the things which I really appreciated about The Deepest Breath, and also Nocturnes as well, is the reflection of sound design of the environment in the score. And maybe I'm hearing things that I'm not sure if you put in there, but it's how I felt, at least when I was watching it. But with The Deepest Breath, there are moments where I felt like I was hearing whales and the sound of heartbeat and things like that. And I was like, that's immersing me even more into the meditative state of this underworld place. And then with Nocturnes, the sound of the moths flapping as well feels reflected in the score too. And I'm curious if you can talk about reflecting nature in your music that way.
Yes, Nocturnes was very immersive. We mixed it in Dolby Atmos. And that was something that was very, very important to the filmmakers, to have that, not necessarily so much a blurring of the lines between sound design and music, but there isn't a huge amount of music in Nocturnes. When you do hear the music, every frame and every note is crucial to and important to getting the experience across of being in the forests and the jungles of the northeastern, you know, the Himalayas. And I used two instruments, so it's very acoustic based score. We didn't want anything artificial, no synths, no electronics, just to be true to the heart of the ethos of the film. And it's, you know, it's very green eco message here about climate change and the world of the moths. And so I used two musical instruments, one which is wooden flutes that could be found in India, but they're never Indian. We always veer away from any tropes and cliches. The filmmakers didn't want any Indian sounding music to put you in that geographical space. But there's an otherworldly sound to the score. And then the other was this amazing instrument played by this unique instrument called the bazantar, played by this musician I discovered who lives in San Francisco. And I've been aware of his music, this amazing guy called Mark Deutsch. I've been aware of his music for years. And I thought one day I'll find a space to have him collaborate with him on a score. And this was the perfect opportunity. And he plays an instrument called the bazantar, and it's a cross between a double bass and a sitar. And it's a very soulful, beautiful instrument. And you hear, it's quite, it's soulful and it's has a lot of, you bow it like a double bass, but it has these sympathetic strings that drone away like a sitar. And it's quite unique. And so we brought that into the film. And I've just finished a series which is now just launched on Apple TV Plus called Earth Sounds. And the whole series is about sound in the natural world. And that was a fantastic journey to go on with the filmmakers. So it's a wildlife show, and it's about how sound is used in the natural world by animals to communicate. For example, you have humpback whales and their songs, which have a deep-rooted ancient connection, I think, to the world around us. They've existed for thousands of years. So the series was a great opportunity to explore that and how sound is used. I learned so much about sound, things like spinner dolphins, how they use sounds to bring thousands of dolphins together in pods through the ocean by leaping out of the water, spinning their bodies, landing into the water again. And that crash land into the water creates a sonic boom that resonates through the ocean and communicates with little micro bubbles of sound and air through thousands of miles, communicating with other dolphins, bringing them all together, and to then use to mimic that and to reflect that in the music score and work hand in hand with the filmmakers and the editors was a really, really beautiful enriching experience.
Yeah, that's quite beautiful. I'm looking forward to seeing that. I did see it on your list and I was like, that sounds like something I would love to lose myself in. You're talking about the selection of instruments as well, and you've got a lot of beautiful instruments on your wall there as well. Yet, I'm curious about if you can talk about the choice of one of the instruments, which people don't tend to talk about with composers because we're talking about usually listening to what you create, but the choice of the instrument of silence, which is so important in some of the films that you've worked on, like in Forsama and The Deepest Breath, where silence and the absence of sound is as important as the presence of music. I'm curious if you can talk about the discussions that you would have with the filmmakers about when silence is best employed in a film.
To me, silence is music as well. Where you choose to have music in a film and where you choose not to place music is incredibly important for the experience of the viewer. I want to take the audience on an emotional journey with the music as much as the filmmaker will want to take the audience on that journey while they're watching the film from start to finish. So that's something that needs time to work out, which is a commodity that we don't always have in filmmaking when we're always rushing to the finish line and when we're editing. So sometimes it's very easy to overscore a film and just to have wall-to-wall music throughout a movie, which is not always, and I think that is born out of fear sometimes, where filmmakers can sometimes use music as an emotional crutch through the film. You have non-stop music because you feel you need to fill up the gaps like sensory overload of having dialogue, talking heads, interviews, sounds, music. It's all crashing into the listener's experience and the viewer's experience. I think if you're smart about it, music is this it's like being a superhero. You've got this amazing tool, this special power, and so if you have silence, you can frame a scene with silence, and then you have, when music does come in, it has so much more impact, you know, as opposed to having music as a crutch all the way through. And so sometimes, you know, occasionally if we're in a rush to the finish line, I'll overscore and write music all the way through, which is very labor intensive. But then when we get to the dub, sometimes the dub is the first time that the filmmaker has the opportunity to sit back and go, right, we've now holistically look at the film as an overview and think, do we really need music in these places? And we start pulling music out sometimes. But it's always best to have that working it out before. It's best to have worked it out before you get to the dub. So with Nocturnes, for example, which is quite sparse musically as a film, but where, you know, but the placement of music is super important. We chose very carefully those moments of the storytelling moments of where we wanted to have the music. And even with, for example, with something like Forsama, I initially scored, wrote a very different style of music, which was very Hollywood-like and quite tense and thriller and action-based and orchestral and with synths and electronics. And then there was a pause in the edit halfway through the process of making the film. And we realized that the film had to go in a different direction. The film became much more sparse and intimate. And it was a human relationship between a mother and a daughter. And when that was realized, that happened, the music that I'd written no longer worked because it was too overpowering for the film. So we started stripping things back. And there's one scene in particular I remember where they're driving in an open-top vehicle through the streets of Aleppo with a lot of, and there was, before I changed it, there was a big tension-driven action piece, you know, with a lot of suspense. And there was a lot of bombing and shelling going on around the characters, around the protagonists. And we took away a lot of the music and layers of music, and we just had literally the drum beat, or like that sounded, felt like a heartbeat, and all we had was that element going on. And when you watched it, you thought, I can't tell whether this is music or whether this is bombing and shelling happening at the same time in the scene. And that was incredibly effective because you had this underlying tension heartbeat, but then you also had the bombs going off in the scene, and it really put you there in that moment. And that's just, and it was so much more effective. And that's just one example of where you're kind of blurring the lines between sound and score in the landscape. You know, the two most powerful moments in that film have no music on them. And we actually put music on. There's one where you see the death of a brother, of these three boys that bring in their brother who's on stretcher into the hospital. And we had very emotional music playing at the time. And we thought, hang on, let's take the music out. And I thought, oh, the music is, we don't need traditional music here. It's so much more effective by not having it and not being over manipulative. And I think that's, we're always in danger of doing that. And it's the hardest thing for me as a composer to do quite often is to restrain and hold back with the emotion. It's very easy to ladle on with, you know, a strong syrup of emotional honey on top of everything. And I think, you know, you can be a lot smarter with music by holding back, restraining, and leave the audience wanting more That's always, you know, a better way, I think. It's a challenge to get there. It's not an easy journey. You know, you're trying different things out. It's like throwing mud against the wall. You're experimenting and trying things out. You know, and every project has its own unique set of challenges. That's, you know, like I said earlier on, it's like you're going on that journey with the filmmaker to find the right path.
What I love is how pragmatic you are as well, because, for you, the score is your way of reacting to what you're seeing. It's your expression of your emotion, and yet realizing that the work that you've been working on is not going to fit with what's on screen. That's got to be a hard thing to process, and knowing that, you know, you might have spent months on creating that particular piece of music and maybe nobody will hear it. How do you deal with that?
It's heartbreaking. sometimes. Yes. I mean, you know, I'm going through it at the moment on a project. You have to learn to be, you have to have a thick skin. And every time I write a piece of music for a scene, in a film, you put a little piece of your soul into it. And so you learn, you know, when I send my music off to the directors and the editors, and they listen to it and go, I'm not sure this is working, or can we change this? Can we, you know, chop and change? That's fine. But you do learn to, you become very emotionally attached to the story, to the characters, to, you know, it's very, it's a bit like, you know, method acting. It's a bit like method composing. And so I do become attached to things, but then you realize, you know, you can always see a score, you can always see a film from a different perspective. There are many ways of climbing the same mountain. And so it's all about serving the film's needs. Yes, I'm there to serve the director's creative vision of the project, but I'm also ultimately, I'm there to serve the film's vision and the film's needs. And that's irrespective of everyone and everything involved in the film. The film then becomes its own unique being entity, and also the feeling of inevitability that when you put a piece of music onto a scene, it should always have that feeling of it's always existed, it's always meant to be there. And so, you know, that's why the one very challenging thing writing music is making it feel seamless and understated and never forced, so that when you're watching a film, you don't notice the music at times. Sometimes the music is very, very subtle, but it's there holding the viewer's hand. And that takes a lot of thought and process to get to that point, to make it feel subtle and understated. But then sometimes you want the music to be bold and strong and really lead. So it's finding that push and pull is always a fun challenge. So yeah, I get very attached to my music, but then I know that I can be very sort of detached as well. You know, so spending time away from the film is good. So that I'll work on something. If I'm working on a piece of music, I'll have a good sleep and we'll come back the next day and listen and watch it with a detached view perspective and go, oh, actually, that's rubbish. I better start again, you know.
I'm curious, like I've talked to a lot of directors and producers and writers and composers too, but, you know, each of them goes to their own education or building their own creative library. You know, a writer will read a lot of books or scripts, or a director will watch a lot of movies. But I'm curious for you as a composer, how you build and access your sound library, not just through scores, but through the world around you. How do you maintain and access that yourself?
That's an ongoing problem I have. I mean, I have at my fingertips, I have access and built up a sound library of thousands and thousands of sounds. And so cataloging and metadata on a technical level, just organizing all of that is a huge task. You know, I, when I started composing, I had very limited resources and, you know, just a handful of sound libraries and a laptop and so on. And perhaps I was at my most creative then because I had a limited resources. Now I have so much at my fingertips. So I think what I do on every project is I create a unique sound world for each project. And I'll spend time curating a sound library, creating a sound palette, and create a framework, create barriers for myself. I go, right, I'm only going to use a kazoo and a didgeridoo for this score and a violin, and push that to its limits, as opposed to writing with thousands of sounds on every project. And I did that on Nocturnes. You know, I thought, well, I'm going to use only an acoustic sound base. I'm only going to use these two musical instruments and a handful of other string sounds. And that was pretty much it. So, I do have, I'm a stickler for creating, for having, you know, lots of sound libraries, having a database, very efficient computing system. I now have a system where I can, the laptop that I work with now is incredibly powerful, has thousands of, you know, terabytes or gigabytes of data that I can take anywhere around the world with me to compose. That's something that appeals to me a lot, to be able to, you know, I used to have a big studio with lots and lots of gear, and I still do. I've got a lot of synthesizers and acoustic instruments that inspire me. It's very playful. It's a playful environment, and I like to mix up my work approach instead of sitting in front of a computer all day, which I do inevitably, but I do like to pick up the odd stringed instrument or work on the piano or try different sounds and things to mix things up. But I'm more excited about taking my computer with me and traveling and composing and being inspired by other locations and other places and working in that way as well.
I mean, I can hear the passion in your voice for what you do, but I'm curious then how you manage to separate between the work and your own personal creativity. Do you have your own personal creativity with music? How do you distinguish it between the two?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been a composer for film, to, you know, writing music for other people's stories and being part of that collaborative team work. And so only just recently, I've worked for the first time, I've worked on a project that's pretty much me, which has been the biggest creative challenge I've ever taken on. I've written the music for a huge outdoor art installation that's going to be coming to Australia at the end of the year or early next year, actually, in Mildura. It's a fiber optic symphony orchestra, and been collaborating with an artist, Australian British artist, who's created this amazing light art installation that's going to be outdoors on the edge of an escarpment in Mildura. It's launching in California first later this year, then it's going to move to Australia. And the music has come first. The only brief that I was given was to write for a full symphony orchestra, a 30-minute work. And so I was inspired, I've actually been inspired by nature and mathematics and all sorts of various things. But it was a very, very difficult project for me to work on because I could write anything. And so it was an opportunity for me to find my own creative identity, to answer your question, to find my own voice, which I've thoroughly enjoyed. It's been a fantastic journey for me personally. So I can't wait to unleash that upon the world soon.
Oh, I'm already thinking I've got to get to Mildura next year. Like, that sounds so exciting and so visually striking as well. I can imagine what it would feel like. I'm excited for you and for anybody who gets to experience it. Yeah.
Yeah, so I get to, I'm hoping I'm going to come out to Australia for the launch of that when that happens. It's going to be very, it's a really cool project.
Yeah, sounds very cool. Which leads me to kind of the key thing, which is obviously AIDC is a major aspect of why we're having a chat, but it's also, as I've noticed, you know, listening to so many interviews that you do and the amount of support that you give everybody and all this kind of stuff. And I'm curious how you manage your time and how important it is to be a point of contact for people who are interested in getting into the industry and learning about it, you know, doing conferences like AIDC. How important is that for you?
Yeah, I mean, that sort of this outreach and educational work and in speaking is, it's really, really important to me. It's part of what I do. It helps, you know, I love speaking to young emerging composers and also trying to share my, I wouldn't say I'm an expert at all because I'm still learning. I'm always learning on every project, you know, but I know that when I was growing up in the industry coming up, I had no mentors. It was very difficult for me to find my path. It wouldn't say difficult, but I have a wide, broad, I have a very an eclectic, unorthodox route into the industry. And so, I love, you know, when people ask me to share that with them, I love doing that, but because I used to love going to conferences, I love going to film festivals, and AIDC is just an amazing, it's my first foray into a major festival in the Southern Hemisphere, you know, on the other side of the world. So I'm really, really excited about that. I have a curiosity about all sorts of people in the world, and I speak at universities, and also being a female composer, there are traditionally there haven't been that many of us out there, so I do speak at universities, and I think I'm a part of initiatives to support, you know, inclusivity and diversity is very important to me, because I know how hard it was for me to come up in the industry with a lot of barriers, you know, 20, 25 years ago, and how things have changed and are changing. It's an ever-evolving landscape, you know, it's a very much more open industry now. I mean, there are still challenges, but there's been so much good work that has been done, and you know, and I love being a part of the music industry of but also the documentary world. You know, that's, it's sort of very subjects close to my heart, so I love what I met Tash Gad at Sheffield Documentary Film Festival a couple of years ago. We were both on a jury together, and we had a fantastic time. You know, it was an amazing discussions that we had being on the jury. And we sort of kept in touch. And so when she invited me to be a part of AIDC, I just snapped, said yes, and grabbed the opportunity because, for me to personally, being selfish, being able to explore what's going on in the industry in Australia on the other side of the ocean is something that's fascinating to me, and makes me realize we're also all the same. You know, there's so many people that I realize that I know that have reached out to me when they heard that I was speaking at the conference, people that are from my past career, you know, over the years, I had no idea, who are based in Australia now and doing amazing work. So it's just, you know, being able to explore the stories that are coming out of Australia and the entire region is fascinating to me. You know, there's such diversity and such richness. It's a very exciting festival to be a part of.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, I mean, I get to speak with Natasha almost every year, and it's been a real treat getting to know her through her work with the conference, and getting to see how she creates it as well has been wonderful. But it's been a real treat to be able to talk with you. You've been very generous with your time, and I really appreciate it. And the wonderful discussions that we've just had has been very eye-opening and you know, enlightening for me as an, you know, documentaries are my passion. I love that. I love all films, of, you know, as we both do, but documentaries are what I love, and getting to experience it through different ways is just quite delightful. So thank you so much for your time, Nanita. It's been a delight. Thank you.
So much for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you again for listening to this episode of the Curb Podcast. I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Nanita Desai. And if you do, please seek out her music. It is on most of the streaming platforms. I listened to The Deepest Breath quite a lot this week, and I have added into my regular rotation of scores that I listen to now when I write. It is quite a peaceful and calming score. Her panel for The Art of Composing for Documentary is going to be presented at the Australian International Documentary Conference on March 5th at ACME in Melbourne. Visit AIDC.com for more information. And additionally, to help keep The Curb independent, please visit patreon.com/thecurbau. For now, we will see you on the next episode. Thank you again. Bye.